MMT and helicopter money are monetary socialism. Martin North, John Adams, Wilson Tsai, in the interest of the people. John, hello.
Hi, mate. How are you going?
Good. Wilson, good to see you again.
Hi.
We're going to talk, John, about MMT. And the question, of course, is why now are we talking about MMT?
Sure. So a couple points to make. Now, we have seen, and we probably covered it in our recent post about the economic emperor. We are at big risk of going into a whole series of very unconventional policies, whether it's negative interest rates, quantitative easing, MMT, in terms of helicopter money. So we're starting to see a lot of this now becoming mainstream. Now, I was picking this up last year, so this is why when we first started doing our episodes last year, one of our very first episodes was The Madness of Modern Monetary Theory. I wrote an article about it. We did a video about it. We got a bit of a mixed reaction to that particular post. Half of the audience thought it was good. Our discussion, some of them thought we misunderstood what MMT was about. I mean, you've done a recent interview with Professor Stephen Howe from the University of Adelaide, who's an MMT advocate. I had some significant problems, to be honest, with how he was explaining the rationale in terms of MMT. Now, where I thought we would take this conversation is, Wilson does enormous amount of his own economic research in a whole variety of areas. And he's got his own website. He's written some very lengthy blog posts about a number of these topics. So he's written a post about helicopter money, and he's written a post about MMT. So now, again, I have a view. Wilson is his own man. He's got his own independent views and thoughts. So I thought, in part of this conversation, he's a mathematician, an economist who's looked at this stuff very deeply. It'd be important to get another voice into the conversation. And this title, now, some of the audience is going to say it's provocative monetary socialism. So this is not me saying it. This is actually Wilson's writing saying that MMT and helicopter money is monetary socialism. So I thought that's this is why I think it's important to have this conversation, and obviously have another person who's looked into this history to give his point of view about this topic. Because as we go forward, there'll be more and more discussion about this because the government's actually going to do it.
Sure. And in fact, ANZ has just come out and said, forget quantitative easing, let's go straight to helicopter money.
Yes.
There's a lot of attention at the moment on alternative ways of trying to solve the current economic crisis that we're in.
Yes. So you got ANZ, I think maybe 6 weeks ago, Citi said helicopter money. And in 2016, you had NAB. They had a research paper about helicopter money. So the banks want this. And why do they want it? Because they need the government to print more money to prop up the financial system and to prop up the banking operation. So the banks have a vested interest in this unconventional policy. But the question is this policy in the broader economic and social interests of the Australian people? I take the view no, but I think the purpose of these sort of discussions with people like Wilson is to actually get into the theory and the nuts and bolts and where did this stuff come from.
Great. So Wilson, let's just perhaps start with a little bit of a contextual question around the current conduct of monetary policy, both in Australia and around the world, because essentially post the GFC, we started seeing some unconventional stuff happening in terms of quantitative easing and lower interest rates. And now around the world, it looks as though we're running out of steam on those particular levers. So people are grasping for other straws, aren't they?
Yes. At the end of the day, a lot of these different ideas are really not different at all. Right? They're basically a way of using different means of redistributing resources. That's, in other words, if you print money, if the government prints money and give it to people, the people that receive the money is able to demand real resources using that money, right? Well, where does those resources come from? The act of printing money has not produced those resources. Right, so those production goods and services, right, to which, without the money, those people would not have been able to get. So what they get, someone else must lose.
Mm.
Right? So money, printing money and giving to somebody is a way of redistributing real goods and services. Okay? That's the first thing to get clear. Right? Now, let me define socialism. Socialism is a way of redistributing wealth and goods and services, right? As opposed to capitalism, which says that goods and services belong to the people who produce it. That's called the concept of private property, right? If the government come and takes those things and give it to somebody else, that is socialism. In other words, there is a lack of respect for private property. Okay? Now, I do not want to say that one socialism is good or capitalism is good or bad. No, this is just a way of analyzing what it is that's going on. Those are the basic concepts. Right.
So there's a contention between the capitalist model that says, drive profit. Profit is owned by those who create the profit, right? And the other side, which says, but we have to do some redistribution. We have to intervene in that process in some way to enable redistribution to happen, to shift some of the value around across the economy, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And those two things are pulling in different directions potentially, although it seems to me that we seem to be getting to the point where one is getting closer to the other, which is a bit interesting.
Well, I personally don't want to use the word profit necessarily with capitalism, even though if you're a corporation, you go look for profit.
Yeah.
But capitalism really, at its very basic foundational level, is the respect for private properties.
Right.
Right. And by saying that, it means that the government doesn't take your private property and use it to do whatever it wants, right?
Mm.
And so the only people that really can deny property are the powerful state, the government, right? So socialism has a big government,
mm-hmm.
and capitalism, would have a small government because they don't believe that what you create, the wealth you create, necessarily is best distributed by somebody else. Okay? Now, so this brings the question of how modern money theory and helicopter money is used to redistribute wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of the government overtly take money from out of your pocket and then give it to somebody else, as in taxation, for example,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It can create money to achieve a similar effect, right? So with helicopter money, the idea of helicopter money is that it was the image created by Milton Friedman, who thinks that, well, can we stimulate the economy by just printing a whole bunch of money and dropping out of a helicopter? The whole idea was he believed that if people spend the money that they get from nothing, then that would stimulate the economy because to me, that is another mythology in economics, that spending creates wealth, right? They have it constantly, the reverse causality, right? I believe, right, you have to produce before you can spend, because unless you produce, you have no goods and services, right? So even if you have money, it can't buy anything. So to me, I'm like the classic supply side, you've got to produce before you consume. But it's a Keynesian fallacy to say you can increase consumption and magically the goods and services appear.
Mm.
Because if you press them to say, how can consumption create economic growth? Then they'll say, oh, well, unless people consume, there's no incentive to produce, right?
Mm.
Okay, if that's your argument, then why don't you look at what where the things need to be produced, right? So your focus should be on production at the end of the day, even though you say you need consumption, right? So MMT is another way of creating money. The only the theory of MMT says that we can print money and spend it and manage the economy because the money we create belongs to the state. The state has the power to say this is money, and that's where the charterism came from in the early 20th century. That predates the hyperinflation of Germany, right? What they said was that, the guy that was caught napped, what he said was that by controlling the state, be able to control money, by controlling money, they can control the economy. So if the economy needs stimulation, you create more. And the modern money theorist says that if we want less money, right, we just tax people, right? So by doing this, right, they can control the economy, right? But there's a problem in this assumption, because if you go and study the quantity of money and all this sort of stuff, right, there's no direct relationship, right? There's no better example than the last 10 years where the huge amount of money through quantitative easing have been produced. The amount of money they produce should see a boom time.
Mm.
And yet economic growth has never been weaker. You know, even in Australia, around the world, economic growth's falling. So the assumption that money can control the economy is flawed. MMT and helicopter money are essentially the same idea. The only difference between helicopter money and MMT is that helicopter money is sprinkled willy-nilly to everybody.
Mm.
Or some people call that people's quantitative easing,
right?
A lot of people say that quantitative easing has not worked, mainly because it wasn't given to the people, right? All the money went to the banks. They say, well, if people got the money, then the economy would be much better off, right? So they say, well, you can print money and make sure you give it to people, and then that will work, right? But that argument doesn't wash either, because when government run budget deficits, right, which in the United States has been running huge deficits for years, they give this money, a very large part of that money is given to the welfare, which is consumption. It's effectively financing consumption, right? What has happened to the U.S. economy? It's not all that crash hot either, right? So a lot of these people, a lot of things that people say, they have absolutely no basis, no empirical evidence, no theoretical evidence. You ask them exactly how does all this money produce goods and services?
Sure. So Wilson, when I've read your papers, there was two key points that sort of jumped out at me. The first one is you've argued that when you implement, and you just sort of made the point there, so let's just be clear about this. So when you implement MMT and when you implement helicopter money, and the government is increasing its role in the economy by producing budget deficits, you see a lower amount of private sector investment in the economy because the government is actually controlling more economic resources through the expansion of the money supply, and that leads to lower growth. So if we saw these unconventional policies in Australia, we would expect, as debt continues to go up, a lower rate of private sector investment, this crowding out effect, which economists have talked about, and that will lead to lower economic growth. So that's the first point. So that's basically your thesis, correct?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, you look at what happens when government run deficit, right? Now, contrary to the, well, the MMT people got this mechanics wrong, right? Because they said that government has to spend, right, before people save. Well, that's completely against the evidence of how things work. When governments want to run budget deficit, it issue bonds into the community. Normally, people would be happy to buy up the bonds, right, and give the government money. With quantitative easing, not enough people want the government bonds, want to lend to the government. So the central bank, or in the Australia's case, the Reserve Bank, if we did quantitative easing, the Reserve Bank would buy the government bond and issue money.
Yeah.
Right? That's how money is issued. Now, the idea of the Reserve Bank is that eventually they can soak up this money that create out nothing eventually, you know, by selling the bonds back into the market and retrieving the money and burning up the dollars, right? But as in Japan's case, they create all this money, but they never reduce the balance sheet, so-called the quantitative tightening or reducing the balance sheet. In the United States recently, they tried to do that, and people complain because it has an impact on the economy. And so now they stop.
Yeah, right. And so that was the point that we made in terms of our post around the economic emperor. Mm. Once you start quantitative easing, you can never stop it because you can't get the private sector demand.
Yeah.
And it's Bernanke said it would be temporary debt monetization, and they could reverse it. No, it's actually permanent debt monetization.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. So that leads to lower growth.
Now, the important point about why that is just money printing or very similar to helicopter money, except that money didn't go to the ordinary people. If that money went to everybody, then there would be helicopter money. But because that money went to the banks, they call it quantitative easing or whatever, right? Now, the thing is, this debt on the central bank is only a trick, because the central bank is part of government. So government is owning itself money. So the government owns central bank, but the central bank's owned by the government, right? So all that is just really, at the end of the day, sleight of hand. What really matters is money has been printed and circulated in the economy. And so that's why there's no hurry. No one says that the balance sheet of the central bank cannot go to infinity, because it has no effect on government. It has no effect whatsoever on anything, right? I mean, the MMT people do not understand why the central bank was created in the first place, right? Because their view is that central banks are unnecessary, because the government can just create money from the treasury and spend it into circulation. What's the use of central bank, right? The reason why central bank exists is to keep the government accountable. Because if there were no central bank, there'd be no need for accounting. You wouldn't know you don't even need to know how much money you have printed and circulated. And that has happened in history, right? Whenever, whatever government, there's all sorts of governments, the French government, even the Yuan dynasty in China, everywhere, there's at least 100 different cases of government just printing money, which works at first, and then eventually leads to disaster, right? So central banks have been created to give a structure, to give a accountability, to give a, you know, to keep the system from going off the rails. That's why they're there, right? Now, all these people that's writing all these papers, right, thinks that they've invented something new, right? But if you look into history, that's where it's heading, right? So,
Sure. So basically, what you're saying is these unconventional policies will drive down economic growth because it's crowding out private sector investment, but also the act of the printing of the money, it will actually result in inflation because the money, the value of the currency, it actually drops. And then that works for a while until a point and where they lose confidence in that currency, that fiat currency, whatever it is, and that's when you see runaway inflation.
Yeah, well, sorry, I didn't answer your first question about the impact of government budget deficits. The reason why it doesn't work, right, is that when government print money in running budget deficits, right, or borrow money, what they're doing is they offer the bonds to the market. So if you were an investor, your business, individual, you got a lump of money to invest. What you do is you say, look, I can go and start a business, make things and sell them, right? That is real investment. Or I can buy the government bonds with a very definite return, okay? That you have a choice. So whenever the government runs a deficit, it's offering people a chance to make a financial investment rather than a real investment. And if you look at the data in the United States, they invariably take the financial investment and forget about the real investment. Mm. That is all there is to it. You don't need to invoke interest rate supply and demand, driving interest rate up and down. The interest rate does not work like that anymore because the central bank fixes interest rates. So it's the market, it's not market forces that determines interest rates. I mean, is that clear? Right? The government has a very large influence on interest rates. So whenever the government runs deficit, it's just simply offering to take money from people for a certain return. And so whenever one government run deficit, there's less and less investment.
Yep.
That's it. And it's really the investment which create economic growth and production.
Okay. So what you're saying is that MMT takes us down the wrong rabbit hole.
Yes.
Right? Effectively, it reduces the chance for productive investment.
Yeah.
And in fact, people are grasping at this because the quantitative easing strategies have run out of smoke. But in fact, they're taking the solution further away rather than closer. That would be your summary.
So, John,
go on.
The impulse of socialism, a lot of it today, for example, with in the UK and United States, is income inequality.
Mm.
So in other words, we've got to find some way of addressing this problem. Of course, they think the simplest way is to create money and give it to people, as a redistribution mechanism, as I said, which is socialism.
Yep.
Okay. But they never question how income inequality arose in the first place. If you look at the data, income inequality start to accelerate from about the beginning of the 1980s, right? Which comes with deregulation, financialization, globalization, all that 30 or 40 years of history, right? The chart just shows you steady rising inequality.
Mm.
So the problem is, in other words, giving a lot of power to the banks, right? And the banks manages to make investment which are profitable, and a lot of the profitable investment are bubbles. If you look at the United States, you see all these tech, there are companies like Uber that don't even make any profit, but they create bubbles that the banks make money out of bubbles.
Mm.
Okay, so. So there are a few people, namely the CEOs of companies, and the of course the head of the banks, they make a lot of money. You look at the Australia 250 richest people, they are either in property, there are already certain companies, investment managers, right? All these sort of people. So that's the origin of the of inequality. Now, we are about, if we do have another financial crisis, who's going to pay for it? The answer is, they've already have this bail-in law, ordinary households. Again, right? This will increase income inequality, right? Now, the solution to that is not printing money. I mean, how could it be? That could be the solution to the problem, right? So I think these people are, you know, barking up the wrong tree completely.
John, barking up the wrong tree?
Yes. You know, the thing is that, I mean, so some people know that I work for a gold and silver dealer, and they've sort of said, well, you know, I've got a vested interest. That's why I'm talking about gold and silver. The reality is, I only started buying bullion 2.5 years ago. Why did I start doing it? Because I take an evidence-based approach. We have traditional forms of money, gold and silver. They've been around for 5,000 years. They stood the test of time. When it comes to a currency that's not backed, like a fiat currency, like the Australian dollar, well, the first example of where that happened was in the 11th century in China. And the last 1,000 years, there's been multiple examples of when you have an unbacked currency, the politicians and the bureaucrats, they print too much of it. And just like the process of what, in terms of what Wilson was saying, it ultimately leads to the currency failing. So you know, print too much money. Initially, you get a bit of a spurt in consumption, short-term economic growth. At some point, you know, you start to lose confidence in terms of the currency, lose confidence in the government system, and that's when you have a currency crisis. So obviously, this is, again, when I said to in the debate with Christopher Joy, housing crisis, dollar crisis, because if you print too much of this stuff, people will lose confidence. And you know, I mean, I'll just hold this up. So I mean, one of the points that Wilson made before, yeah, was that the intellectual origins of MMT and helicopter money come from Chartism, which was in the early 20th century, and that led to that school of thought led to the hyperinflation in Germany 1923. So I picked this up in Adelaide recently. A 50 million Reichsmark note printed on 1 September 1923 at the height of hyperinflation. You know, the if we are going to be evidence-based, so there's a lot of ideology, there's a lot of emotion when it comes to MMT and income inequality and the role of the state, etc. But if we're looking at history and knowing that a currency that's unbacked, and if you print too much of it, there has not been a unbacked currency that has stood the test of time, and it ends up in something like this. So whether it's Venezuela, Germany, Zimbabwe, etc., you know, history going back to the 11th century in China, we have seen this process go forward. And so obviously there are significant economic impacts if we embark on these unconventional policies. And my biggest concern has been so far that there is no voice in the public square saying to the ordinary citizen, there are consequences to doing these things, because the banks and the AFR and the ABC are saying, this is great, let's do it. So there's a consequence to it. No one will talk about the consequence. And I think the average citizen doesn't fully comprehend that if you look at a 1,000 or 5,000 year time span, the consequence is that the people, the ordinary people, are going to be screwed. Because when you see runaway inflation, it's the ordinary worker that relies on wages that they get, you know, in the currency that they're paid, they're the ones that get wiped out. And that's what exactly happened in Germany. Workers in the cities that were largely, you know, their income was largely based on wages, they got wiped out. And so runaway inflation is a huge economic and social concern for me. And so obviously, you know, this is why the other side of the debate needs to be expressed. when people say M&T is great, it's a new thing. And hopefully with the conversation with Wilson, perhaps people will again, people need to do their own research and homework on this. But, you know, with I think what Wilson brings to the table is the intellectual origins of some of this stuff has been tried in history. It has been disastrous. And yet we have a new group of bankers, financial people and academics saying we can try it again and we're going to get a different result. And I don't think we will.
So, John Wilson, I think very important discussion that's here. And as you say, it's very important that people get to do their own research and form their own views. Don't just swallow whole that this is some magic silver bullet that somebody's recently concocted, right? There's a history behind it. The history isn't very flash and there are consequences.
Absolutely.
John Wilson, thank you very much.
Thank you.